The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, the Secretary of State of the US, Antony Blinken, has said that the United States will send Ukraine $725 million worth of missiles, ammunition, and other weapons. It comes after the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, in a trip to Ukraine in the last couple of days, promised $680 million of military aid. Additionally, the 32 member states of NATO are meeting in Brussels today with no indication as yet of Ukraine being invited to join NATO. Volodymyr Zelensky has claimed that an invitation for Ukraine to join NATO is a key element of his victory plan. Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin, joins me now. Scott, good morning.
Good morning to you, Pat.
Now, two things going on. One is big money from Germany and the United States to help fund the ongoing war with Russia for Ukraine. And secondly, Zelensky contemplating forfeiting some land in exchange for a conditional peace.
And the two are linked, Pat. The upside for Ukraine and its people are that in advance of the threat of Donald Trump coming into office in January, because he said he'll cut aid to Ukraine, the United States, Germany, other European countries are accelerating, getting weapons, getting other equipment, getting financial aid to Kyiv. And that was emphasized not only by the U.S. and German announcements, it was emphasized by the NATO head, Mark Rutte, yesterday. The downside for Ukraine is that Rutte and other national leaders and diplomats are saying that the priority has to be on those military supplies rather than on fulfilling Ukraine's request for an invitation to join NATO. So what's the problem with that? The problem with that is that for Vladimir Zelensky and the government, and indeed for many Ukrainians, you only get security from a future Russian invasion, let alone the current one, if you're inside the bloc rather than outside it. So there, while Zelensky is willing to contemplate a Russian occupation of part of Ukraine in the short term, he will not go to the negotiating table without that assurance of Ukraine within NATO and indeed within the EU rather than standing apart.
And of course, Russia will not agree to any part of Ukraine being in NATO because he sees that as a pushing eastwards of, if you like, NATO's boundaries and right onto his doorstep.
Right. So there you have the two differences in approach. So German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who was in Kyiv yesterday, has been opposed to bringing Ukraine into NATO or even inviting it at this point because he fears it will box in Putin. And indeed, he crossed a line by actually talking to Putin by phone a few weeks ago, something for which he was roundly criticized. The line that Zelensky and some of the Europeans take, particularly the Baltic states and Poland, is that you have to present Putin with a fait accompli as you go into talks. You have to present him with, look, Ukraine is coming into NATO. Now you can discuss whether or not you will continue to have your forces in part of Ukraine while we discuss other arrangements.
So the idea that you would have some sort of a buffer, the Russian occupied area of Ukraine, as a buffer against NATO being literally on your borders?
Well, I think the idea is right now, Pat, that the Zelensky government and indeed its supporters realize that there's no prospect of militarily pushing Russia out of eastern Ukraine in the short term, even as Ukraine holds part of western Russia, the Kursk region. So if you're not going to militarily be able to push the Russians out, then you have to look to the diplomatic route. And the diplomatic route at this point is pretty similar to what we had during the Cold War with West Germany and East Germany, which is that West Germany came into NATO. West Germany, of course, eventually came into what became the EU, whereas East Germany remained under Soviet influence for about 40 years while you tried to work everything out. It just took a long time to get there.
Now, there is another front for the Russians at the moment in Syria, where they're backing the Assad regime, and the fall of Aleppo is a setback.
It's more than a setback, Pat. You know, in a conflict which goes back to March 2011, when Syrians protested for rights, justice, and reforms, the ability of anti-Assad rebels to take Syria's largest city, and indeed much of Aleppo province, much of neighboring provinces, within 4 days, is just an exposure that the Assad regime is really effectively a paper regime in terms of its purported control of Syria, and that it is propped up by Russia, by Iran, and by Hezbollah, and that because Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah each have their problems elsewhere, Russia in Ukraine, Iran across the Middle East, Hezbollah inside Lebanon, that without an assurance of that support, the Assad regime won't fall, but it has no assured control of much of its own country.
We hear about the rebels taking over Aleppo. The characterization of those as rebels, I mean, who are they? Are they former Al-Qaeda people? And if they were to prosper, what sort of regime, what sort of governance will they put in place in Aleppo and beyond?
Yeah, that's an important question, which has just been overshadowed by repeated misinformation and disinformation. So let's cut to the core. The largest faction amongst the anti-Assad rebels is called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, so HTS. They were associated with Al-Qaeda until 2015, and they broke from Al-Qaeda. So they established their own Islamist approach. Now, they are Islamist. They do have a form of Sharia law in the areas they control, but they are not Al-Qaeda by any means. And there are other factions in the rebels who are not Islamist, who actually are more secular in approach. So there's a coalition of groups.
So we're not looking at a kind of a Taliban-type regime, should they win.
Well, this is not Taliban. This is not the Islamic State. This is not Al-Qaeda. There will be a question if those groups control Aleppo City for the future, and I think they will, in terms of what type of government you have. There will have to be negotiations over, you know, social legislation. There have to be negotiations over the way that you run the administration. But those negotiations can take place without the type of, you know, dramatic, nightmarish prospect that we had under the Islamic State just a few years ago in Syria. And I would have to say that with Syrian friends, Pat, they say that those questions of who will govern Syria is something that will have to be worked out, that there will be times where there'll be tensions, but that it is far preferable than the fact that they've seen hundreds of thousands of their own countrymen killed by the Assad regime in recent years.
Now, going back to the question of NATO, this comment from a listener, isn't it interesting that Putin had no issue when Finland joined NATO after the Ukrainian conflict started? That added 1,340 kilometers to Russia's border with NATO. They didn't have a say in it one way or the other. The Finns decided that their best interest would be within NATO, knowing that that would push NATO right up to the Russian borders. But that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, this is why Putin lost the invasion of Ukraine, even if he holds some of the territory in the near future. When he went into Ukraine in February 2022, he not only wanted to conquer Ukraine, he wanted to basically show strength to other countries, including the Finns and the Swedes, to say, look, you need to be aware of getting too close to the West. It backfired. Both Finland and Sweden, which had been cooperating with NATO for years, made the decision, we're formally going to join the bloc. Putin brought that about. It would not have occurred if he had not invaded Ukraine. And similarly, you're looking at other countries such as Moldova, which is Ukraine's neighbor, which are pressing to join the EU and to come inside the EU. And indeed, Georgia, where we have tension going on right now, a swing of the population saying, look, if Russia is a threat to us, it's much better that we go ahead and openly join European institutions rather than stand in the middle.
And yet the ruling party in Georgia is saying, we prefer to be within the Russian sphere of influence than be part of the West. And their president, who's a bit like a Michael D. Higgins, doesn't have any executive power, is saying the contrary.
But it's significant that the president, who might not have the executive authority, would be bold enough to say not only that what the government is doing is wrong, to rule out any approach to the EU until 2028, but that the recent elections which put that government in power are flawed. And you have now got 5 nights of protest with tens of thousands of people on the streets in Tbilisi and in other cities. And those protests possibly could grow because of the government's stance saying you can't join the EU. And it could be that Georgia 2024 will be a repeat of Ukraine 2014 when the president's refusal to allow any movement towards the EU brought about his downfall and brought about the changes that bring us where we are today.
Now, just to correct something that appears to be believed by many people, this is from Robert in Cork. Trump never uttered that he will not support Ukraine. Members of his campaign have said this, but he has not. Recently, he's been quoted as saying he will give Ukraine more than Putin can possibly imagine if Putin doesn't agree to peace. I don't know what to make of that, because the impression has certainly been that Trump is an isolationist. He doesn't really want to be involved in foreign wars.
Donald Trump has said many things, which sometimes make sense, sometimes don't. Robert's point is a good one, that he has sort of changed a bit. But here's the fundamental. Donald Trump despises Volodymyr Zelensky. He despises Volodymyr Zelensky because Donald Trump blackmailed Ukraine in 2019. And Zelensky wouldn't give in and dish disinformation on Joe Biden. And that led to Trump's impeachment. And that is why Trump this autumn has said that Volodymyr Zelensky is a salesman ripping off the United States for billions of dollars. So even if that's not an explicit, Ukraine does not get aid, it's as good as saying, no, it's not going to be the case that we allow Zelensky to get the military and financial support that he needs. And of course, Trump's vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, has said he would cut aid to Ukraine. Trump's biggest supporters in Congress have said they will cut aid to Ukraine. There are certain cabinet nominees who may not go that far and pay close attention to the National Security Advisor, a man named Mike Waltz. There, in other words, might be a battle within Trump's cabinet about whether or not aid would be cut. But no one should believe that Trump is on the side of Kyiv, especially given his record of being on the side of Vladimir Putin since 2016.
Another question from a listener. Remember how the Taliban overran Afghanistan after the Americans left? In the same way this has happened in Syria, what has Assad been doing all these years? Has he not built up his armed forces while the Russians did the hard yards? That's from Kevin.
The Assad elite for years maintained what was in effect an autocracy in Syria, where they reaped the economic benefits of it. But the country itself was economically fragile, even before 2011. What happened, because you in effect have a wartime economy, as the uprisings became militarized, is that Syria lost more than half of its GDP. Its currency, which was 47 to 1 versus the U.S. dollar in 2011, is now in the realms of around about 15,000 to 1. So the currency is almost without any significant value, which means that the Syrian economy and the Assad regime's power relies upon assistance which comes from outside. It comes from the Russians. It comes from the Iranians. It comes from Lebanon's Hezbollah. And if those groups can't keep providing the aid, well, Assad's military simply becomes a force that has nothing to keep it propped up.
Finally, Scott, on an American domestic issue, the question of Biden's pardon for his son Hunter, criticism from Democrats and from Republicans. And the principal one from Democrats seems to be, given what Biden has done, doesn't that give a free pass to Trump to do exactly what he wishes when it comes to pardoning all sorts of people?
As an analyst, Pat, legally, I disagree with this. I don't think any president, whatever his name, Clinton, Biden, Trump, should be allowed to intervene in a judicial process. Politically, I agree with that criticism, that it means Trump can now justify his past pardons of all those who were involved with him, over his connections with Russia, over all those who were involved in trying to overturn the 2020 election. And he can justify his future pardons in January, including those of the people who entered the Capitol on January 6th. Yeah. As a person, however, Pat, and as the father of two adult children, I can understand why he did it. He simply, at the end of the day, said that he didn't want Hunter Biden to be subjected to all this political pressure when Hunter has been clean for 5.5 years, especially when the Trumpists are going to take control of the Justice Department and FBI and try to bend them to their will.
Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.